Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft.
Welcome to the worlds of WordCraft. English 115F, Fall 2007, Vanderbilt University. Professor Jay Clayton, Professor Matthew Jed Hall. Visit our class blog at worldsofwordcraft.wordpress.com.
Seth is so excited by the possibilities offered by the Fairy Queen that he just can't control his and contain his enthusiasm.
I think that's what it is?
I'm positive that's what it is. Seth, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, sir.
Good answer. Here's what we got starting off week 12. We're going to talk about a couple of the readings. Who did not do the reading? Anybody? Good. Good to hear. So Matt Shelton's going to be happy to lead us in that discussion today. Who did not get Neverwinter Nights successfully installed? Raise your hand.
It's like in the process.
I don't think I have the right graphics card or something.
But that's a possibility. I've had a similar experience.
This is a pretty new computer. Like, I got it right before school.
What we asked you to do from an assignment perspective was get your copy of the game and then play the game. So now, and this is, as Wesley and I were talking about a little before class, whenever you desperately need technology to work, this is a joy of working in a digital age, it will fail you. Right? So that's one lesson we should all walk away from this experience together with. So we will work through some of the issues. The key thing is that you persist through the problems and you get it solved, and we will do that together. So your assignment was to have played Neverwinter Nights 2 before arrival in class. Who did play? Let me see all the hands. So you got a chance to play the standalone games.
Barely. For a minute.
The idea is not to make you Neverwinter Nights experts, guys. The idea was to get you started, to force the conversation, to force you thinking about the difficulty of the interface. Who found it difficult to play? Warren?
Like, you mean difficult to, like, quest through, or difficult just to get used to, like, the interface?
Any or all of the above.
The camera was really hard to adjust.
Yeah. I hate that camera.
You can adjust it.
I hate the way you move.
No, it's, like, so sensitive.
Yeah, I don't like click and move that much. I mean, it's okay, but...
I got a tool I'll show you later for script.
Okay,
all right, I just got 2 minutes after class. Yeah, I'll have to show her to download it.
Okay, sweet.
I think, Chris, you're the most experienced Neverwinter player in this group, aren't you?
I had, like, a 14 monk a while ago. I almost beat the game.
Dude, I had a monk.
Yeah. So I think I'm going to have to volunteer Chris. But I've seen him, with some degree of facility, he can navigate Neverwinter Nights. And he understands the mechanics of it. So Chris will, I'm sure, be happy to help us all as we work through this together. So the idea was to get you to play it. I will explain in a few minutes as we get into the day's course what we are going to discuss. And we'll talk about Neverwinter Nights 2 architecture. But the real discussion is from our book. Matt, you're going to need that chart a little later, so it's a good place to land. This is a book about game design fundamentals, rules of play. Right, and that's the whole, remember, our movements through the class. We started the first third of the class as we're trying to become more sophisticated consumers and appreciate the various expressions in various media. So we did film, we did book, we did movie, right? Those are the three basic forms of expression. And then we had a video game based upon our film and our book, Lord of the Rings Online. So we were now able to participate and live in that world and experience the narrative threads. I'm sorry, what?
Anything you'd like to share with us?
Yeah, anything you'd like to share?
Yes, I would.
Chris and I are concerned over here.
Yes, you should be. I'm trying to get this guy somewhere so he won't die a horrible death so that I can then participate.
We want Professor Clayton to participate with us.
And we also want him to live.
Yes, we don't want him to die, though, at the same time. We understand how important it is to get situated for the next loot drop. We don't want to miss the barrel shard, I think, is what he's after.
Ancient iron deposit's really important for safety.
I don't think it's the iron deposit. I think he wants some fat loot is what he's after.
Okay.
So the first third of the course, we had an opportunity to see stories, narratives, expressed in different media, right? Part two of three was the content. We really wanted to examine Spencer's Fairy Queen. Very easy, light read. which we can then take. I think we all accept and agree this is a very easy, light, enjoyable read. So something easy that we could all get our hands around, and then take that content that we have enjoyed so much and move it into this virtual space. And this is this session here is going to start the very basics of game design. So the thing that we took for granted, and even you go back to Jesper Juul and talks about some of the categorizations of games from our early conversation, what is a game is a question. Professor Clayton, could you move us back to our smart notebook?
Indeed. Is that where you want to be?
No, keep going to the smart notebook. NWN discussion or whatever, perfect.
My friend LOL'd, I told him it's D&D based.
Okay.
Don't you
LOL? So a couple questions I want to explore. Really, it's what's a game and what's a magic circle? Based upon, and you know, Chris has a chart up, which we'll be talking about in a few minutes. But from reading that article, what were some of the characteristics of games that definitions that were presented in the book?
There's a set of rules.
Yeah. That was the big
pretty much everybody agreed on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Goals.
That's
objective.
Completely
voluntary.
Well, not even, I don't think they even unanimously agreed on that one.
On the chart.
Yeah, they did. I had to highlight
they didn't,
it.
No, they didn't all agree on.
We'll get to the agreement part because I've got the chart we'll put up on the board in a moment. I know Chris has it up, and I suggest those of you who want to follow along, pull up the same place that Chris has on his machine, which is that chart on the PDF file. But tell us about what were the definitions that were most striking to you that you felt you had some harmony of in your mind as to what a game was?
The one that said, there's one, I don't remember exactly what it said, but it said that there was the option of failing, like, you didn't always win. I don't remember exactly.
The possibility of failure, is that the one that discussed the psychological benefit of risk, that we can experience risk without actually being subjected to the true physicality of risk?
I actually disagreed with that one. I think that only works for certain type of games, because if you think about sports, you're not really simulating anything and removing a risk from it. You're still, like, if you're playing, like, football, there's still a risk that you're going to get hurt. So I think that only applies to a certain subset of games.
Yeah. Love that they were ultimately focused on a certain kind.
Jeff and Michael and Matt?
I like the one that, Definition 8, it says, it was kind of all-encompassing. It said, games are an exercise of voluntary control systems in which there's a contest between powers confined by rules in order to produce a disequilibrial outcome. So I think that was kind of like... got most of the other ones combined with it.
Well, I think, like they said, the only part I don't like about that is the conflict between players, because I think someone else said that it's not always conflict between players. They can also be, like, joined together.
Also, that one, it was...
Michael wanted to jump in here.
Well, one thing I didn't agree with was the not never associated with material gain, that two people using the definition, which is... really, like, especially as games become more mainstream, you know, obviously sports are, you know, tied in with material gain. It's, you know, a big part of sports. And, you know, even, like, competitive games, you know, like where they have, like, World Gaming League.
Right.
You know, they get paid for that. That's material gain. It's very associated with gain.
I agree.
Matt, did you have something? You were in the queue,
I was just going to say that it seems like each one of these people kind of... concentrate on a certain subset of games. So those people who thought that it was goal-oriented or outcome-oriented were obviously not huge fans of MMOs, and it kind of just seemed like it kind of ran that way.
Or they were in 1930s.
Wesley than Peter.
Like he said, they were all very subset-oriented, and, you know, also some of them were made earlier. Like, one was someone who was 1930, and the only one that I thought, you know, really worked was the incredibly broad one, but also, like it said in the article, that applies to so many other things, such as money, you know, politics, our economy, and it just made it increasingly obvious that the way we define gaming as it exists, you know, within our minds is so broad that,
he talks about not only within our mind, but within our culture, right? Yeah. There's a cultural context for games. Peter?
Well, yeah, I was reading through the 8 definitions. Everyone did seem to have something wrong with it and something too specific, which is why I was excited when they said, all right, So here's our definition. I was like, okay, they're gonna take it and they're gonna put it all together in a broad definition. That is what games are. So I read system. I agree. Players. I mean, I think game without players would be kind of a little odd. Yeah. Conflict. I think there's a conflict of some sort, even if it's just solving the puzzle or
so conflict versus the system.
Yeah,
there's the
some sort of conflict. However broadly you want to define it. I think rules are required for a game, however rudimentary they are. But then I hit artificial. And I think if you want to define games as something that aren't real and sort of artificial and outside of reality, that's fine. But they also start talking about how the stock exchange is a game and our jobs are a game of sorts. You know, they want to say that these are games and that they kind of made a pass at, well, they're not really real. And I was thinking, well, yes, money isn't exactly real in a physical sense, but we all make it real. And so if our jobs aren't real, then what exactly are they defining as real? They kind of left real something obvious that we all know what it is. And I mean,
Chris Park, jump on in there.
It just says it says artificial conflict is the only thing it names as artificial, which just means that, like, I don't know, that's not happening in the real world. Like, artificial intelligence is actual real intelligence, but it's not, like, in the sense that we think of it as. I don't...
Well, no, artificial says games maintain a boundary from the so-called...
Where are you reading from here?
I'm reading under their definition.
Under our definition, the bullet part of game?
Page 80. Page 80.
Yeah.
If you can see.
After it says their definition, they elaborate on it. It says artificial...
He's reading this up.
That's right.
Games maintain boundary from a so-called real life in both time and space. Although games obviously occur within the real world, artificiality is one of their defining features.
But you were saying how... I think this definition is, again, almost too broad. Because, I mean, as you know, Peter said before, this could be the stock market. I mean, you know, many players, they create a conflict. You know, they're all trying to gain more money. That's the outcome. They have the rules. You know, you have to trade a certain way. There's no insider trading, things like that. It's, again, a little too broad. It's not just talking about games. It encompasses more than it needs to.
So are you saying that the stock market's not a game?
Yeah.
I was saying that.
No, I'm saying it is, but they were trying to make this definition to not encompass that much stuff. But I don't think they really succeeded in that.
Okay, now we could spend the next hour on the various aspects of what is definitionally correct or not. Matt Shelton, jump up to the board here real quick, please. And I think it's the second tab over here. Ben, put that down. And right here, just number two.
Gallery.
Right there. Peter, you counted it up. What, there were eight different citations? Eight citations. How many attributes, Matt, do you see there?
15.
I see 15 also.
So we got eight guys with 15 different attributes. Is it from looking at that chart with all those checkboxes, do we have a consensus among eight fairly scholarly, well-informed anthropologists, sociologists, philosophers? No. What do you think, guys?
Yes.
No.
I think you can say
yes.
I don't think they all thought about the all 15 aspects of a game when they were defining what a game is.
Well,
I think a game is.
We'll come in. I want to come out to Daniel.
I wasn't a great comment. I was just saying that you can pretty much say that the idea that there are rules to the game, everyone pretty much agrees on.
So that's the one thing they have a fairly
that's
good
the one
consensus
thing.
On.
They, but I really just think that like all the different things they're saying, like they just say it in a different way. They all have pretty much the same idea of what a game actually is.
Hmm.
Daniel, go back to your point again.
I don't think any of them except for I can't read who that is thought of a game as a form of art.
Well, I think our form
of
art.
I think if you would like
repose
a question to all these people, I think that you would find a consensus among them for a lot of those 15 different definitions.
Yeah,
that's kind of what I was going to say. I was going to say if you give this chart to all eight groups, I think there'd definitely be things where they'd say, "Oh, well, yeah, like I guess the game does have that." Like, let me put a check next to my name in that box. I think people would change. Because a lot of these are, like, ideas that, like, yeah, you could, say, define a game, but you maybe wouldn't necessarily come up with on your own. But then seeing someone else say it, you say, yeah, I guess that works.
Jeff, you
were... I was thinking, all these people are from different time periods. And there are different concepts of games. Like, you have board games, you have playing tag to MMOs. If you had them all from our generation, all these scholars from our generation writing about games, they would probably all have very similar views because they've all played very similar games.
Why do you suppose I chose this article to even have a discussion about? Isn't a game just common sense?
Well, it's a progressed.
I'm a few more bars on that.
Like, exactly what he was saying. It's game as definition has changed so much within even the past 30 years, with the invention of video games, online video games, electronics, and stuff like that, whereas every one of them is probably right in their own view, but it's changed so much that I'm sure, like everyone said, if we go back and ask Harlett what he thinks now, it'd be totally different.
Did anybody grow up here in a major metropolitan area? I mean, like downtown New York City or something? Anywhere like that? And the reason why I ask is, I don't know, who's not played like a pickup game of football with your friends around the neighborhood? Anybody not done that? Right? Football. Group of kids. Me and my guys, that's all we used to do. We didn't have video games. We had three channels on TV, and parents would monopolize the one TV in the house. We were outside playing football, playing baseball, something of this nature. Where would just six kids in a neighborhood playing football, is that anything? Can we attribute these attributes? Proceeds according to rules that limits players?
Yep.
Volunteering.
Is there an outcome that has to occur? A goal-oriented outcome of football? What's the goal of our
score?
To each a rank and score.
Okay, but there is a score. What is the event that signifies the outcome or score to know that your side, that your squadron
superiority
has been? Now, what's the mark?
Touchdown.
What actually happened?
Points.
What's the mechanic that I score?
What indicates that? Crossing the line.
Movement.
So you're taking this round. Think about this out of cultural context. Football is not something universal. I'm sorry. I'm getting upset, Daniel. But outside of our context, this strange pigskin, this odd-looking, semi-oblong round thing, to move it down 100 yards, step over a particular line, and say, score?
Glory.
That's glory. That's a beautiful thing. Why is it a beautiful thing?
Because of the difficulty involved.
It's an art, according to Daniel.
It's an art. I'm with Daniel, too.
Yeah.
Right? So you've got this thing. There is a conflict between two people. But what about this efficiency discussion through here? Inefficient was one of the discussions.
Very efficient.
Yeah. Well, think about golf and football. He made a good illustration about golf.
That made me feel a lot better about being really terrible at golf.
That made me feel better. Personally,
I can put the ball.
I've always thought about taking the bloody ball and, sorry, forget this stick thing. I want to walk in. Plop.
Hope it bounces out.
I mean, just jump in, guys.
In sports, the glory is found in the difficulty and the skill involved with winning a game, just like it's all the obstacles you have to get by on that 100 yards.
Even though it's inherently inefficient.
Yeah, your score, your winning that game represents the skill that you have that it took to get that score.
Okay, but you could be efficient at the game.
Yes, you can.
Well,
Peter and Chris, yeah.
Games aren't. You want what?
I don't like inefficiency because they gave the example of, you know, the track star runs around in a circle. He could just cut across the field. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there are other kinds of races which are point A to point B as fast as you can. Like sailing around the world, you have to get to a certain country by whatever means on your boat as fast as possible. It is about efficiency, and it's about efficiency of travel. It's a game, but it's also like, there's no unnecessary obstacle.
But you could take a plane.
Then everything could be inefficient.
World, I'm not.
But okay, being inefficient at what? You're not really specifying. It's like
being efficient at the game is what I mean.
Maybe a distinction, guys. Line. A game versus play. Play versus a game. What do you think about this concept? Anybody want to articulate the concept? Matt, have you written this part of the concept? You think you can?
As far as, like,
what's the difference between a game and play?
Well, I mean, play,
as he defines it,
the goal. Yeah, I think play is a broader term because you can just be doing like anything and consider a play, like when you're a little kid. Like they're talking about when they're two like puppies just chasing each other around or whatever. There's no real goals there. But games, you have to have play in a game. But then again, you're striving for something in the game.
Any other thoughts about Professor Clayton? Do you have anything to add?
I'm interested that you said that play is broader than game. because his exact point was in some context, play is broader than games, and in other contexts, games are broader than play. How were games? Who can tell us how games were broader than play?
I mean, it's because you have to, like, play is sort of a verb within a game. The play within the game is defined by the game. So the game sort of, like, limits your play, and in that way, games are broader. And then he also made, I don't know, I thought it was kind of ridiculous, but he said, this whole book is about games, but not really about play. So that's how games are bigger than play.
Now, the whole purpose, I just want to get to why am I even provoking or inciting this conversation, right? In fact, you don't have to stand there, but you're welcome to stand there in case I need you. I like to see you up at the head of the class, though. That's a beautiful thing. What do you suppose I'm trying to get at with all these discussions about game, play, rules, game definitions?
Setting us up for the programming stuff we have to do.
Well, after fashion, it's leading in that direction. It is about moving towards design. Go ahead.
Because we need to know what we have to create.
Yep.
Because we can't just go in there blind with everyone having a different definition of what we're going to create and then try to throw it together, because it would be, do we have 17 people? 17 distinct, different little chapters of something that isn't coherent at all. It would be like terrible paragraphs in an essay.
It needs to be original. We can't just come in and copy WoW or copy LOTRO and have, you know, exact, we don't want to have, or copy Neverwinter Nights, do it. We need to make this something new, something different, something, you know, revolutionary. Well, I don't know, revolutionary, we can't make it revolutionary, but it's got to be, yes we can. Yeah.
That's
what you
think.
It's got to be, you know,
I think that's taking it a little bit far.
I think we need to redefine it in order to make it our own.
But why is it taking a little bit too far?
I mean, we're already using part of Neverwinter Nights to make the game Mountie How we make it so great.
There is a constraint of the tool set that we've selected.
I mean, hypothetically, if we had unlimited resources, we could with what we're talking about.
That's a great point. And here's what I wanted to provoke with this conversation. I'll get to it. You take eight guys, smart, bright individuals, and ask them to define a game. They're inconsistent in the way they define it. I dare say one of the things that's incredibly absent from this piece of work, and maybe one of you guys could say that you saw it and I just overlooked it, fun as an element. I mean, it's kind of implicit in there, but it was so mechanical, so clinical. I mean, why do we play pickup football? Why do we invest our time in reading a book or visiting a narrative interactive experience? Could be various motivations. I would dare venture to say we're going to have some fun. Same way we watch and enjoy a ball game on television or we go to in person. So if you have these guys with varied definitions, Jonathan, go ahead and jump in there.
Yeah, but some games are not fun because they're not designed, like, they're not well designed, they're not fun. I mean, if a game fails to be fun, then
and
it's
you're still playing
a
game, right?
Yeah, but it's still a game.
So it's a game that you're playing that's not fun.
Yeah, whether it's fun or not.
And so I think, that's why it's not a part of the
definition. Say that, like, about absorbing.
Right.
Or something they did say, if it's not, like, an absorbing game, that doesn't make it not a game.
I've been absorbed by really unfun games because it was a really wonderful world with terrible rule mechanics. Things like this.
Or sometimes you're absorbed just because you're locked in, like, a competition with somebody else. Like the balloons games or whatever. They're really not that. They're not really, you know,
beat 'em all
amazing fun games. But, like, if you're playing them with somebody else, then you're going to be... You're gonna be really into it, trying to beat the score or whatever.
Jetman,
another example. Not a good game, but
I love that game.
Well, guys, I think you deal with this. One of the classic statements. I'm gonna paraphrase. I can't even. Professor Clayton, perhaps you can help me out the attribution on this. Someone was asked, "How do you define pornography?" And what's the definition of pornography? So the response is, "This is rhetorical." The response is, "I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it." Right. I've spent a lot of time as I was making strawberries vigorously thinking about this topic.
Illegally farming strawberries.
Oh.
Game reference.
Yes, it was. Making strawberries in game.
Okay.
Thinking about this and reference. You know, a definition of what's fun, what's a game, that's an antecedent to the ability to design a game. for us here. Let me move back over to another illustration. I'm pressing the screen like it worked like it's this way. Game design is a process by which a game designer creates a game to be encountered by a player from which meaningful play emerges. And that's kind of the experience that I think we should be after, is that we're going to do a game design in here. And we can look at some this at least gives you a kind of a theoretical backdrop for how people would approach the world that we're going to make an attempt at designing. And I think one of the things we have to do is set some expectations, because game design, game development, and I think Chris can attest to this with some things he's trying to do, is not incredibly easy. It's a very detailed, not only design exercise, but it's a very detailed execution exercise. To be able to execute successfully requires immense attention to detail and a lot of precursor in design. So that's really, there is no really good definition that I found. We can use this, a game as a system in which players engage in an artificial conflict defined by rules that results in a quantifiable outcome. I have a problem with that definition. Anybody want to talk about the role-playing game genre? RPGs. Matt, you started mentioning that earlier. You alluded to it.
As far as how it discerns from this definition?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. If a role-playing game, I mean, guys, I have my Dungeons & Dragons books, the old-school books, 1978 books, right here. This is a game to me. However, based upon this rule that results in a quantifiable outcome, checkers results in a quantifiable outcome, football results in a quantifiable outcome, does a role-playing game result in a quantifiable outcome? Matt Shelton's first on the list.
Maybe not. It depends how you define quantifiable, because at the end of every quest, you are allotted experience points for that, and there's a progression of your character, and so I guess, no, you're right.
I mean, there is no end in game.
Right.
Because you can rebirth the character if it dies. Seth?
Well, I think your avatar is a reflection of your experiences, and so that is an outcome. Like, at any point, your character has you know, advanced some level and gained some kind of gear, and that's quantifiable. And an outcome doesn't necessarily mean the end.
So getting the next piece of loot is an outcome, but not the end. Ted, Peter, and Daniel.
Well, I was just going to say this is really similar to what we just wrote our third paper on, in that, like, I think we can all come to the conclusion that within an RPG, the player creates his own sub-narrative within the general narrative of the game. And so, based on the whole game design thing, we need to, like, think about, like, how can we get millions of different people to be able to, how can we make this so that they can create their own sort of, so like, how can we make this general so that they can make their own narrative within this? So.
Interesting outcome.
The thing about RPGs is you can make them what you want to be. So, I mean, generally when you have a campaign with friends that you're running over the course of a long time, and you just sort of have to make cliffhangers. You don't want there to be an end because you want to keep playing the same characters, the same sort of overarching plotline the next time. But I've also been to things where it's a one-time shot. It's like a game day or something. So the person is running an adventure where they need it to sort of make sense. There needs to be a beginning and an end. Otherwise, you're just kind of rolling dice, not really doing anything. So it's sort of like a movie. He hands out the characters, and you just sort of play through an adventure, and then at the end, you stop the aliens, or you make world peace, or whatever the goal is. There actually is an end to.
So it's an RPG rule set, a framework in which narratives unfold?
Yes. I would say so.
I would say that's it. I mean, I still think, I disagree with this definition, but that's the side of the point. I think there are games within that framework with quantifiable outcomes. Seth points out, getting that loot is a goal. You have a conflict with something to get it, even if it's with the system or a quest, and you get something as tangible as you get with that virtual space. Daniel?
Well, couldn't a quantifiable outcome in an RPG be the fun you get playing it?
Right there. And that's the end game. Daniel hit it. If we do have the outcome, it's the journey, not necessarily the destination. I think everything I've read here implies that there is a destination, like a score or a victor. Right. Daniel hit the broader thing of why do we enjoy the movie or the book? It's because we do have fun, tangible outcome. Peter, then 10.
Yeah, I don't think fun is a quantifiable outcome.
You
don't?
No.
I had 2 units of fun today.
Two.
Only 2?
It's a comparative type.
Out of 10?
I had 2 meters of fun today.
I had more fun.
You can have more fun than you playing the game.
But that's not a quantifiable amount. It's the difference between much and many.
Oh, now, come on. You guys, I know you say, you have said in your life, I am in a bad mood, I'm in a good mood. You have taken and qualified a psychological state.
But you haven't quantified it.
Oh, well, you can rate it. I can have everybody rate it right now.
Well, I was going to say, it's like a lot like the same system of ratings.
Say it again.
I was going to say, it's a lot like when like you were little kids and on like a sports team and your coach is like, don't worry if we lose, you know, just go out there and have fun.
Oh,
like,
heck no.
You know, yeah, and the kids are like, oh, man. Like, the coach is trying to drive that psychological mindset into you. And I think you can quantify fun. Because, like, you can attribute that to, like, physical feelings that you get. Like, so, like, I'm having fun. I'm gonna laugh. Like, I can attribute laughter to having fun. And, like, how much I laugh, that's how much fun I'm having. So I think you can
move out of this topic. We think that a game unto itself sounds like a common sense term, probably doesn't hold a common definition to everybody. And the way we measure success is going to vary from person to person. But I want to get to the point of the design. Game design is the process by which a game designer creates a game. This is the journey upon which we're about to embark. To be encountered by a player, we're doing this space. You're going to be players in this space. Standalone or multiplayer, you will be experiencing this world from which meaningful play emerges. Let's hope that is the case with what we do. Mm-hmm. Now, this idea, who can tell me this idea or concept of this magic circle? Anybody? What is the magic circle?
Tim's got his hand up.
Go ahead, Tim.
I have a strange analogy. I forget what movie, though, now that I kind of say it. What was the movie where it was like they're playing street hockey in the middle of the street and the car would come and then say, car, and then the car would leave and
game
say,
Wayne's
game
World. Off, Wayne's World.
Wayne's World, right. I kind of have that image where like the magic circle opens back up when you say, you know, car, and they stop playing. And then when you're back in, like the rules are all back into play, everything counts, and it's game on. That was kind of how I looked at the magic circle. Anyway, I don't know if that makes sense. Yeah.
How did other people perceive the idea of the magic circle?
Like, you don't, like, you don't know where in the circle the game starts. Remember I'm talking about this? And then, like, but you know, like, based upon where you began, where it ends.
There's some sort of boundary?
Right.
Okay. Is it a psychological boundary? How do you know when a football game
well,
starts?
Well, no, not always. It's a physical boundary.
Say, Michael, what?
Well, like you started to say, like sports arenas are a physical boundary. Once you step inside, you know that you're kind of separated from the real world and you're in the, well, I guess you'd say the game space of the NFL.
I think a football game.
I ran across, I guess it's Raymond James today, Raymond James Stadium Field when there was no football players on it. That was not a game space to me at that time. What was the psychological difference between the day I happened to be in Tampa Stadium?
Wait, but didn't you still know it was a game space? I mean, you don't walk onto a football field and go, what is this? You know, it's a football field.
Why people don't use it to,
because
like,
it's got
there.
Markings on it and field goals.
So, it's line powder in a form on the
ground. But there's like a preface, like
what does it have
cultural.
Oh, so there's a cultural aspect to game.
Bingo.
How does he do it, ladies and gentlemen? We'll be here all day.
It seems to me that it can be most concretely defined as in space of time, because you can say you can have a game based on your intuitive just how smart your intelligence you there are no boundaries. You have an hour to find these things. You can go anywhere, you can do anything, you just got to find them, and there's no space, but there's a space of time, and there, I mean, the boundary could be time, it could be a certain space, but I think boundary needs to be a broader term in order to define the magic circle.
I want to stick with the football field thing because that is a physical space. We all have a cultural reference to it, so there is some trigger. How do you know a football game is about to start? How did I know just randomly sitting in the field? Are there not the new... Jump in.
I think it's once the ball is in the air on the kickoff. I think
that's when the football game starts, at the kickoff.
The thing is, when they said that it's sometimes hard to tell when the game is and you have to like have seen a football game before, I kind of disagree, because when you know, like, okay, you do have to know the basic rules, but when you hear a whistle, that's like game off, and like you're no longer in the circle. And then when this ball is snapped, it's game off. I guess you do have to have seen it, but I don't think it's as complicated as they say.
But aren't you thinking about what you're going to do in the next play?
Yeah, but you're not playing. You're not actually going. I don't think that's part of the game.
Yeah, but part of the game, is it not part of the game for you, the coach, to think about, okay, what play are we going to run?
Yeah, but they think about that all week.
Yeah,
so my point is, I think the game...
Oh, so that's part of the game?
I think the game starts as soon as you start thinking about the game.
As soon as one game ends, the next game
starts. So NFL
is always a game, because like, they think about it all year.
Maybe in Daniel's mind it is.
Yeah.
He's like, on a leap year, what does he even say? Pro Bowl commercials?
I was thinking about the commercial with, like, what's his name for the Broncos, the safety?
John Lynch?
Yeah, where they're like, where the guy's like predicting like what he's going to say.
Finish up this conversation with football game. Got Ted and Seth want to add something to this.
Well, if we like think about it the way Daniel was just thinking about it, like we can think about like our first reading of the year, Mackenzie Works Gamer Theory. Like everything's a game. So
right.
Like, the second you start thinking about it, like, you know, you can always...
You've entered the game space.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's the way we, like, as far as knowing when the game's starting, like, how do we know, like, today, like, I could go on to Dudley Field and just sit there and be like, okay, what is this place? But I think we know that, like, it's a cooperation and communication between everyone around here. It's like, okay, there's a game on Saturday. It's going to start at this time. Everyone agrees that the whistle is going to be blown, so...
So it's, you know, there's a demarcation point for various people when that gameplay starts. When you go to a movie, how do you know when the movie starts?
The lights dim all the way.
Mm-hmm. I'm getting to the psychological moment of the movies. This is the magic circle applied to a cinematic experience. How do you know, Seth? You want to comment on this, or are you going back to the football?
I can comment about like when the unicorn flies across the screen. Yeah, I mean, you can tell when the opening credits are starting. That's when the movie's beginning. And then, you know, you hear the music. That's the intro.
On the movie thing, when my family, the movie starts when we're on Fandango looking at trailers.
I was also going to comment on the game. Last year my friends played this game called The Game, where you're losing if you're thinking about the game. That's the entire game. And that they played this for real, and they would, like, have references to the game all the time. It's like, that was a game for them. And I think they really had fun playing it. I hated it. It was so obnoxious. But they played the game. So it's the same point as he was talking about. Like, if you're thinking about it, that's part of the game experience.
It's part of the movie experience, thinking about it before and after. It's just the lights dimming and the first projection on the screen. Is that how you know the movie's beginning?
The play of the movie, like playing of the actual film.
Think about the precursors that got you to the movie and the motivations that got you into that movie. Why that movie? Of marketing and all this economic business, that's not what I'm talking about. Any thoughts on this? That's the same thing, because I wanted to do that and then hit a book. So why do you open up a book? When does the book experience start?
You've heard the book was good from someone else or some other form of media or however you found out about it. And that made you want to go see it and spend your time.
Teacher told you to
is a good reason?
Sure.
It's the best reason in this case.
I don't really think there are answers to any of these questions, because I think it depends on the person.
Ultimately, I think Tim's hit it. You are writing for, producing films for, and developing games for a player to engage in meaningful play, to engage, and various people write. We have Brian and Professor Clayton here, who are deeply versed in various aspects of literature. Why do writers write, guys? Make a book. Professor Clayton, is that the only motivation why writers put pen to paper?
If that were my motivation, I would have been...
He'd be an IT guy.
It would be pretty poor outcome over the years.
to share it. There's various motivations as to why. I think to summarize this magic circle idea, there's a psychological point, however you define it, and I think Tim puts it to where I wanted to get to. It starts at various points. Daniel's game in the NFL season probably starts different from people who view the game starting as someone puts their foot to that ball and kicks it, you know, at the beginning of the first quarter. Two different starting points, the same experience or the same time frame around the experience, you know, your starting points. So you have to consider this, and to Tim's point, when we're doing the game design, who are you designing for? Right? Consider this. Consider, when is that game experience going to start? Is our Fairy Queen starting solely with just the Fairy Queen? If someone comes to the Fairy Queen online, what you think about this? It could be a Renaissance scholar. What is their psychological baggage going to bring versus someone who is a 16-year-old surfing game spy and sees the words Fairy Queen online and said, oh, what's this? What do you think that's going to mean to us? Nothing?
We have to choose one that we're going to entertain.
Do you?
No.
Unless you want to, I mean, I guess the, obviously the scholar is going to want to see a lot of, like, narrative and, like, history in the game. It's going to enjoy that part of the game. And the 16-year-old is going to enjoy the killing and the, you know.
Chris?
That's stereotypical.
Well, I think what, well, one of the best things about Neverwhere Nights is that the conversations, if, for one, you don't want to listen to it, you just keep clicking, click, 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 you all through it in, like, a second. But if you want to take your time and click one at, like, every 10 minutes, then that's fine. Take your time, read or whatever. But so I think it's possible to have, like, exciting encounters that also have meaning in them. And if you want to skip the meaning to them, great. If you want to take your time, like, 90% the meaning and only 10% the fighting, that's fine too.
There's another big difference between a narrative-based game and a, gamer-based, is the PvP element. There's a lot of people... especially some games, you make the PvP element within the game, or you can choose to have it separately, and you can have the PvP completely independent. And if you're someone completely narrative driven, then you can choose to stay away from the competitive part of the game. Or if you're a gamer, 16-year-old gamer looking for having a fun time or competing with someone, then you can choose, if you wish, to have some sort of competitive spin on that game.
Something Max alluded to earlier, which goes right to your point. You're going to have to make design decisions and choices, right? PvP, yes or no, is going to be one of the decisions you'll have in a multiplayer version in space. Because PvP can disrupt the environment if you're going for a different goal.
PvP, you mean a PvP server with two factions?
It doesn't matter about factions. I mean, Neverwinter Nights is a system that allows you to have unadulterated, faction undifferentiated player versus player, if that's what you wanted. You've got some... Were you going to make a comment?
I was just going to add another difference between... depending on what crowd you're trying to cater the game to. For the more scholarly crowd, like, the dialogues, the context and all that of the quests before probably wouldn't have to be as rich or anything, because he'd know what's going on. He'd recognize characters. Mm-hmm. He'd recognize events. You would know it's modeled after the book, while the kid surfing the internet would have no idea about the plot, and you might have to include a little bit more context about what's going on.
Interesting.
Mr. Clay, do you have more to add on that?
Yeah, that's a very interesting thought. I wonder if you all are now experts on an abridged version of Book 3. Would you, when you come to a character, would you like to read a little bit about it, the character?
Yes.
To be reminded?
To know some background.
Yeah, because it's not going to be fresh in your mind. And then there's also, I think, a pleasure in being reminded of something that you enjoyed once before. So that, you know, say you're a professor of Spencer, way more expert than the 17, 18 experts currently in this classroom. I think that you might find it just really fun to see these things that you've studied for so long kind of spatially mapped out for you. And so I think we're really going to have to work hard at evaluating how much we put in and how much we leave out with each encounter.
It's a very important question about the audience.
Nice.
And yeah, it's one of the things that you need to think about on Thursday and before you come to class Thursday. To whom do you want this to appeal? Games, I hope that at the end of the day, the message I got in this section of the discussion was games mean different things to different people. People experience the same event, the same physical space, the same set of activities in different ways. And some people, because of cultural variation and context and understanding, will walk onto an American football field and not know what's going on in the same way that if we all go to France, we're going to have a different experience as to what's football. And cricket's a different story entirely. If you like 12-hour days, that's the sport for you. So think about all these things as you move forward. What I want to move transit to now is the medium in which we intend to express our remediation of Spencer's Fairy Queen. Now, Professor Clayton asks that everyone bring their Fairy Queen to class in digital form or otherwise. Who has that readily accessible?
Lovely.
Bring that up, please. While you're getting that situated, I want to talk to you a little bit about Neverwinter Nights. Neverwinter Nights is based upon a gaming system that we went over in our chronology of gaming. It's called Dungeons and Dragons. Dungeons and Dragons was what we call a pen and paper based system. There was no necessarily a board. The display I have up here from the Wikipedia entry on Dungeons and Dragons, the game, they happened to utilize graph paper, miniature figures to help orient themselves spatially during the context of the role-playing game. You can do this entirely within the context of your imagination and conversation. Who has not played an RPG, Dungeons and Dragons, for example? Raise your hand. So I see one, two.
Wait, you mean like a real life?
Who has not played a real life?
Never played Dungeons and Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons game.
Whoa. What do you do with Warhammer?
that's similar, but it's not the same as an RPG. Right, let me flip it. So what, we got about five people who have. Who's played D&D? Who's actually played D&D?
That's what I thought I was answering.
Who's not?
You guys need to teach me how I want to try.
So we've got four of us have actually played this. This is the history of NWN. This is the wellspring through which NWN, Peter and Matt and Michael, can you try to, it's really difficult to explain if you haven't experienced it. There are other things that are similar vein, but how do you describe the RPG tabletop pen and paper experience? I mean, there's at least you can see what it could look like, but that only shows a physical presence. How would you describe a D&D session you've played in?
You have a set story or a set quest or a series of quests that a dungeon master, who is the creator of the game, has made for you, and when you go there, you're oblivious as to what he has planned for you, besides what he wants you to know, a background. So it's kind of like going to a movie, and you literally play through his story that he's created via your character or your avatar that you've created yourself. So you're taking your avatar through someone else's storyline and someone else's conflicts. So whether the story is very battle-based or puzzle-like, it both venues work for this type of game because it's so open and broad. The rules are so broad.
I mean, I would agree, except that the way we normally played it we played it since like middle school, off and on. But where it's evolved to is basically the person who's running it will create the world and will usually have a bunch of sort of stock NPCs, and then we'll have the major ones, and we'll just have a map and just sort of a storyline. And generally the first session will start off with like a quest the dungeon master has for the players, just sort of get them into it. But after that, it's sort of like the players each have their own goals, they each have their own, the characters that they're running each have their own wants, and so it'll sort of, depending on how the characters interact, it'll basically push the dungeon master to run what the characters want to run, as opposed to the dungeon master like forcing the character, it's called railroading, I think, railroading the characters into what he wants to happen.
Those are abstractions. What is typical session? I mean, those are all, and I agree with them, they're very important because there's some terms that I want us to grapple with and at least have an understanding that, that Matt and Peter mentioned during our conversation. What did the actual session experience look like?
Well, these guys are nerds because they're using the Dungeon Master shield. But
and you're a nerd because you recognize
Other than that, call them out. Of course I'm a nerd. But anyways.
I'm proud of it, too. It works out good.
Usually, yes, we use a mat, and you have the little what erase markers. So
do you have the mystical talisman on your wrist?
Of course you do.
The,
mine now.
The what?
It's not a wrist. Look at the talisman. Look at the talisman. That's right, Daniel. You look.
Let's say the characters. We usually use abstractions before like a battle scene occurs. So the characters, let's say, they're coming upon an encampment of enemies. The enemies are around a campfire.
You're a dungeon master. How would you portray that? If you'd be the dungeon master, I'll be one of your players. How would you do this?
So you, let's say you're a rogue.
I'm a rogue, yes.
You're a rogue, and you say that you want to scout it out. So
Peter, I'd like to scout out the encampment, please.
All right, well, make a move silently check.
Move silently check, and how would I do that mechanically?
In D&D 3.0 or 3.5, you would use a d20, and you would add your move silently modifier.
Okay, so there was, this is just person to person. There's no mechanics other than a knowledge of a rule set and a set of books to arbitrate. I think I'd pass this around. This is the old school. He's talking about 3.5. There are combat resolution and other checks I'm going to find for you here. I roll D20. 17.
Hmm. All right, and then I say, all right, I think that's good enough. And then Jeff, who's our friend who knows more about the rules than the Dungeon Master, perk up and, yeah, talk about things, says, well, isn't he walking through high grass? Like, doesn't that give him a plus penalty or a minus penalty? And you say, okay, and then you have to flip through some books and find the real rule, or you just say, screw off, Jeff, we're just going to say it works. And then I'll draw, perhaps, I'll take my little black marker, because we lost all our other color markers, and I'll just draw a campfire and then a few tents, and then, because we don't have the correct models, I'll have, like, a golem and a goblin, and I'm just going to be like, these are just people.
So what did I find in the encampment, Peter?
You find three men sitting around a campfire, and there's a tent behind them.
I want to sneak into the tent.
You want to sneak into the tent?
I'd like to sneak into the tent, please.
All right, you go into the tent, and you see a man tied up and a bunch of loot and supplies and stuff.
Take the loot and leave. Is that okay? I'm going to grab it now. I'm going to grab the loot, and I'm going to leave.
You receive a negative alignment modifier. Negative 3 alignment modifier.
Plus 1.
The guy turns into the Incredible Hulk.
So then what happens? I'm trying to make off with the loot. I want my loot.
I would say you have to make another move silently check, because the first one's just to scout out around the camp, and this one's like right next to them.
Okay. I roll a 3.
What? You roll a 3? Well, I roll their opposed listen checks, and they get an 18. So
What's that mean to me?
And they enter the tent, and upon seeing a little hobbit trying to take their gold...
Halfling in the case of Dungeons & Dragons.
They draw their swords, so roll initiative.
3. I'm doing bad.
And now we're in combat, so they go based on their initiative. And so one guy will walk up and hit him with a sword, and then you have to roll for the sword.
Okay, so you get the rhythm of the role-playing game. Now, imagine a world... I'm going to pass this around. This is a combat, old-school combat resolution table. One has to do with an armor class, the roll, and the d20 success. These are only the basics. I think, as Peter said, they were very much people of jurisprudence doctors in Dungeons & Dragons rule sets who would really scare you to death. Pass that around. Just that would be
scare you to death.
I still don't know.
Really, and true. They scare you to death. So, Neverwinter Nights, the platform, it's based upon this experience around a table. Mm-hmm. People, and this is a form of remediation by my way of thinking, people enjoyed that system of experience so much, they poured it into a digital world to be able to express yourself in very limitless ways in the contents of the digital world. Jay, did you want to have a few more bars on that?
No.
So we've taken this experience here, and now we're porting it. Now we are intersecting Dungeons & Dragons, ported to the digital age, with Edmund Spencer's work. That's where we're heading.
So
now,
it's like the digital world, the Dungeon Master...
Yeah, we are all effectively Dungeon Master.
I am also going to put up something that I made into a story. You will be essentially the Dungeon Masters. You're going to be the creators.
My, I'm going to see if you can see that. Is that there?
Yeah.
Adjusted. My 8-year-old son, on my first Mithrandale whirl, developed this map.
13 giant rats.
And you know how many giant rats I put down for Mikey? 13 giant rats for Mikey. Yes, Professor Clayton.
That's not your 8-year-old's handwriting.
Yeah, it is.
Wow.
I was just going to say that.
Impressive.
That's better than mine.
It's
better than mine, which is up above. So. I had my boys participate in the making of the Mithrandale world, so they each got to design an area that I would instantiate
that's
in
so
the
cool. That's awesome.
That.
13
giant rats.
Okay. So this was Michael's drawing.
What is the dotted line going to the left there?
There's a secret passage back there.
Uh-huh. Secret Ooh. Passage. And then the two... They're
off to different areas of the,
uh-huh.
of the
those
world.
Are like portals.
Yeah, they go off to certain other areas. Uh-huh. They're actually going out to other places. So Michael, my 8-year-old person's favorite, was rotten food and garbage pile.
Is there any loot?
Where you find giant rats is rotten food.
In Mikey's world, there was a lot of loot. We had to tone down the loot because Mikey liked loot. That's what Mikey liked, was loot. The reason why I show you this map and I showed you that map, was the map, I think, is the basis for spatial orientation. It's the basis for the way in which narrative play unfolds within a role-playing game. Some of the things that Peter and I discussed as we sort of acted out a potential scenario as we approached that camp, important mechanics, but that event took place in some form of broader context. What was the world in that particular case? You had a broader world that the dungeon master created, right?
Yeah.
Now, we've got some limitations on our world. Where does our world take place? What's the name of the land in which our world takes place?
Fairyland.
So we already know our imaginary boundaries. It's within the context of Fairyland. We will have to... you don't have to do this. This is the way I've approached game design. Is start with the map, the broad context. You already know the people involved in this experience. You should be able to articulate who. Name 5 characters from Book 3 that you think are going to be in this discussion.
Fredemar.
Okay, Fredemar.
Red Cross.
Venus. Boosrang.
Cupid. Venus.
Cupid. Venus.
Scudamore.
I mean, there's a lot of people.
Villain. I think the sorcerer would be a good one. There's a lot of fun making that with the sorcerer.
Well, let me make this fun. Let me talk about this. There are 2 types of characters in a Dungeons and Dragons based world. Matt, what are they?
PC.
There's players who are people who, like you and I, who are actual real people, and there's NPCs, non-player characters, and those are people who are automated. They're like machines. They will respond based on some preset dialogue that you have to choose as a player what they say.
Could Brittamar be could in your game design decision, could Brittamar be a player character?
No.
Or no.
I think we almost have to do what, like, in Lord of the Rings, like, they kind of just, Lord of the Rings Online, they don't make you part of the Fellowship Order. They kind of just make it as you're like an extra helping hand that is also doing things alongside all the other people. So I think that's how we have to do it to like preserve the story.
Because if you allow Curtimark to be a character, everyone's like, oh, I want to be her or him. And then, like, I want to be all these characters that are famous in the story. And, like, you know, they're going to have 3,000 Brittamarks and 3,000 Venuses. And it's just going to, it would ruin the
worst to go with.
It's just like an MMO? Or is it?
Well, but see, all these questions, I'm going to reserve those questions. These are design decisions that you're going to have to start making on Thursday while I'm in Colorado. So,
ski trip?
Dungeon Master, you are the Dungeon Master. The thing that Neverwinter Nights relieves you of is in this table, I hope, showed you. The Dungeon Master did a lot of work. The game itself, right, the context of the game, is doing the Dungeon Master work for you. So the rules, I'm trying to see if there's anything of interest there, nothing. The game itself allows you to, all the combat resolution occurs automatically, but you know, if you watch Neverwinter Nights, and this is why I wanted you to play it first before we came to this class, did you see a d20 roll anywhere?
Not on the volume.
It was a d20 roll. They were rolling d20s. This is based on a d20 system. Okay, so the Dungeon Master role is important. I think your assumption of this DM role is in the act of creating the story.
you also have to decide, now that you know that this is your role, what stories and quests from Book 3 are going to be remediated from Spencer into that space. Characters, forget the player character, you will have to decide the NPCs. And these are all words that I heard between Peter and Matt and Michael. As we talked, there needs to be a map. We have to find spatial orientation. Brian brought a book for us. What's the title of the book, Brian?
Mapping the Fairy Queen.
The idea is, what is the physical spaces Edmund Spencer conceived it? Have we made a determination on this, scholarly?
What is
our scholarly judgment of our two experts here?
Basically, Fairyland is England, but distinguished from southwestern England, which is Cornwall.
Where would that be?
Okay.
I just conveniently happen to have a map of England handy. It's just that random act.
All right, so Arthur comes from North Wales into Fairyland. England is never actually referred to in the poem. It's always Britain rather than England. So basically you've got Arthur coming from here. Britomart comes from southern Wales.
So we think Britomart starts off in southern Wales somewhere.
Yeah. She starts in here. Artigal is... This is Cornwall down here, which is just part of England, the country of England now. I don't know what its status was in 6th century England, which is when Arthur would have been there. Basically, when you have Britons in the poem, they're coming into Fairyland from basically these areas. There are other parts in the poem where Pict land is referred to. The Picts, I don't know much about the Picts, but some sort of Celtic people from, 6th century, around there. It's referred to as north of Fairyland. So basically you've got all these clues orienting Fairyland as right here.
So I think Wales and Middle England would be the context.
Yeah.
Do you concur, sir?
Yeah.
So I think that is the basis around which we'll draw a broad concept map. I don't have that map rendered in the way I would like, but I want to show you something here on how this can work. This is a map framework I constructed. It's on a product called Campaign Cartographer 3. As I said, maps are the basis for spatial orientation. Let's just for tickles and grins say that's Middle England. Right? And what we wanted to do, where do you think, and you guys are all, where do you think, where would Castle Joyous be? Just so we know, I'm going to make an assumption here. Let me not jump to conclusions. Does anybody think Castle Joyous will not be represented in our development efforts?
Well, it could be a different name or something.
No, yeah.
Castle Joyous.
No, I'm, well, not if it's Fairy Queen Online.
We're running rapidly out of time.
No, I don't.
So, you got 10 minutes?
Yeah, 11.
So, to that question, I'm going to stick with that question. Who thinks it will not be represented
kind
in
of
our map? Go ahead, Michael.
I just said it's kind of important not to be. I mean, it's one of the main locations that is visited in Fairy Queen. So I mean, I don't see how we could make a game called Fairy Queen Online and then not include Castle Joyous.
Where do you think Castle Joyous should be? And we'll let Brian come in at the end of that of your assertions. If this is Middle England, where would Castle Joyous be? Think about where did.
Bristol.
Where did, and you guys brought Britomart, encounter Arthur and Guillaume to begin
south,
with?
Should
be southwest. Where Bristol is.
North is up. Look at the compass rose on the left. I've given you north spatial orientation there.
It should be where Bristol is towards the south middle southwest.
Now we've got one towards the middle southwest. Let's go back to...
It's not going
to
be central. The central place should be where it all culminates, like Mr. Wright's castle maybe, or something like that. Like, see where Bristol is?
So we've got the cursor right by it.
And
who disagrees with Wesley?
Because that's around where
Max does.
Very much so
like right where Wales.
show us exactly where you think it would be, Max.
Does Britomart start in Cardiff?
If Britomart's from the southern Wales,
then should it be like sort of in the middle, maybe?
Middle
Wales.
Middle Wales, okay.
I'll say middle.
Middle? You got middle? Do you see the time? I'm giving you a prelude of the type of discussion you're going to be having on Thursday. So we're making a design decision, something that we're not beholden to in this case. But I'm going to put, show me, hey.
Yeah, I was thinking of right here.
Chris, yeah. Put it, Chris is going to put, that's Chris's suggestion, he moved it there, of where Castle Joyous would be. Not in the other. There's another suggestion. We're not going to have the floating castle joyous. That is an option, but not noise. Yes.
There are, however.
Yes, Professor Clayton, jump in.
There are in other books, another book of the Fairy Queen, Floating Islands.
Bingo.
Put it where you guys think. Daniel and Chris, put it where you guys think it should be. Just move the cursor, and then we'll see who disagrees. Castle Joyous. Who disagrees with Daniel?
That looks good.
Which the
one to the right?
I think this should be about
I think it should be the left.
Each one copy does have more value.
There needs to be space for a central location.
He's moved it over now.
All right. That looks good. Wait, no, you're moving.
Maybe south a little more.
Okay. So you now started the construction of a contest.
Southeasterly.
Are you guys, anyone in a disagreement that's a spot where Chris is moving?
Wait, you want
I gotta ask more about the map. Are we supposed to pretend that's
Wales,
England and Wales, or is Wales off the map down to
it's
the
England
south?
It's England and Wales. We'll throw this map out and redo it as we.
Right.
This is a very fungible activity. I'm trying to get an understanding of the mechanics we're going to have to go through to get there. Let's say that is, extend a little bit and say this is England and Wales together. If that's okay, Brian, what do you think about that? It's Castle Joyous as a location.
I'm happy with that.
Brian, is that going to click left? Click on that.
I think it's not a bad idea.
Voila. No, just hit escape out of there. Now you have made your first design decision about where the Fairy Queen Online unfolds. The one thing I wanted to show you here, with me a second.
It's too small.
We have to work on our scale issues. I applied a hex grid. For those of you who have played games, including your historical games, hex grids are very important. Because in Neverwinter Nights, we're essentially going to be making discrete areas that transition from place to place, exterior to interior. This is situated in a particular hex grid. Looks like 1008, our map here, which will be the authoritative map for Fairyland when we finalize it. Castle Joyous will have a door, which you'll enter. And then you'll also have to then construct what the interior of Castle Joyous looks like. So now I've got two things that need to be done technically right now, just on this little conversation alone. An exterior containing an entrance to a castle. And by extension, an interior. And what are in the walls of that interior? We find tapestries, good appointments in terms of the physical infrastructure.
Lots of NPCs.
Lots of NPCs. I think there's what, six knights?
Six knights plus six lots of serving people and other kinds of...
The thing is, couldn't we spend our whole time just doing that castle?
Yes, you could.
I feel like it would take so long.
You're right. And this is exactly what I want to communicate. We now have to bound and set expectations about what you're going to do in that game design component. What are your outcomes? Who, as Tim and Max and all of us have discussed, who are you designing for? What are you trying to convey? And then this detailed conception, how are you trying to convey it? Let me show you one more thing, Tim, before I do this. This will be brought off into the Neverwinter Nights tool set. It's up here on the board. Chris, you want to talk about the complexities involved in that since I know you've been playing around with it? What do you think?
Yeah, it's pretty difficult. Like, the item creation's kind of easy, and then, NPCs are a little step up, and, everything else just gets progressively more difficult, I feel like.
Tim?
I was going to say, do we even need to have an interior to the castle? Can we just have a cutscene that describes what happens in the castle? Because I don't remember much from the story that needs to, be done by a player in the castle.
You can do whole, quest arcs in the castle, though.
I just have a question. When you play the campaign, you travel, you can click on different things. Are we going to have a map in that sense? Have a different location on
this,
that?
When you guys decide what the map is, what Anglia, what England looks like, and where you situate it, I will take it and put it in Campaign Cartographer. I will convert it in a way that Neverwinter Nights can do it, where you have an area map of entirely a Fairyland context within.
Okay.
That's awesome.
Okay. All right, so we're going to have to stop this part of the conversation. Chris, check my time for me, because I need to finish up one other set of concepts.
5 minutes.
5 minutes. So you guys need to, I'm going to have to talk through this with you.
I'm not going to have a lot of time for discussion. Apologies for the handwriting, but I want to at least show you
the architecture of Neverwinter Nights. Let me do one more thing up here while we're talking. This is important. There we go. This is a classic 1979 Dungeons & Dragons module. A module, and you'll notice that the files in Neverwinter Night, when you look at them inside the directory, are called .mod. You're creating modules. This is the paper analog you would see Fairy Queen Online. And we will, one of our tasks will be to do a D&D-like cover for Fairy Queen Online. That's something. At the end of this course, in about 2 minutes, we're going to ask you to start assigning yourself to groups. We'll do a sign-up sheet in some capacity, maybe right up on the board, and figure out how we want to apportion that, or maybe Professor Clayton has to deal with that in the next session.
So.
We're going to do a module. The analog to this paper module, this is one by the person who developed Dungeons & Dragons, The Keep on the Borderlands. Go on Wikipedia and read this, guys. It would be really beneficial, The Keep on the Borderlands. There's a module that's on nwevolved.ign.com. Chris Park will know where this is. You can download this module for NWN2. I played it last night.
Oh, yeah. I had it on the first one, too.
Keep on the Borderlands. I did it on the first one, too. You can play that module online so you can see how it carries over. We're going to be doing the same thing, except ours will be Fairy Queen Online. Right? So now, the module, the .mod is a file. You're on Neverwinter Nights. I'm calling this a Neverwinter Nights client. It's your PC, your laptop. It's my lame illustration here. Right? That's where the system runs. It turns out on Neverwinter Nights 2, the reason why some of you are having connection problems, you actually have to have a copy of that .mod file in your My Documents Neverwinter Nights modules directory. Right? So we'll get into that 2 weeks from now after Thanksgiving on how we deploy that. I just found this out. That's what was the riotous uproar in the forums. Right? Neverwinter Nights, the first, did not require that of you. This one does. But we will have nwn2.vanderbilt.edu. It's up, operational, and tested. And we're going to have two elements. Someone can take the Fairy Queen Online and play it by themselves. They can download the module. Have a single-player experience. But the good thing, and the reason why I spent the time about Dungeons & Dragons, is Dungeons & Dragons is an inherently social activity. That's why the server is essentially, in this case, the game table through which other clients can connect. So at that server, you'll have the gaming table experience where multiple people come together to experience the same place and time and space together. So you also need to think about what multiplayer does versus a single player experience, which adds another layer of complexity. So, Chris, I'll check my time for the course.
50 seconds.
Okay.
49. 48.
Okay. So, I think that's all I'm going to have to talk about here. There are some, let me just leave it at that, because there are some complexities about doing the design. We'll pick up in a couple weeks. I encourage you to read about the Electron tool set. I'm not sure if that's whatever the code name is this month. It's the tool set that comes along with Neverwinter Nights 2. Learn a little bit about the mechanics. Chris is my appointed expert on the topic to this point. Yes.
So for next class period, there is no assigned reading. So you get a vacation from assigned reading for next class period. Bring your Fairy Queen to class, and I want you to go over Canto 1 before class and identify who. Just kind of make a census for yourself. Who's in Canto 1? Where? What the locations are? And what happens? Just in Canto 1. It's very short. Come into class ready for us to start having a discussion about which of those who's, where's, and what's we're going to put into our game, okay?
Thank you for your time.
See you on Thursday.
Time.